Great. Well, it's good to be back here. Are we going to get a mic for Mike? A mic for Mike.
Can you guys hear me okay if I use this as a general mic?
He's got a booming voice.
Yes.
I promise we're not going to reach the level of obsequiousness that you find in, like, inside the actor's studio. You know, no slavish here. I actually am one of the apparently rare alumni of the 2000 Signal and Noise conference. I thought I'd see more hands saying they were here too, but then I realized that there's probably not a five-year plan for the Harvard Law School. So it's probably a good thing that not many of you are here. But we're excited to be here. We're real excited to have Mike Doty join us here this morning. When I first saw Mike Doty, it was in 1996. He was fronting the incredible band Soul Coughing. They were playing, I think, a rather unfortunate gig at the San Jose Art Museum. As part of, I think, what was then called Interactive World or something. A great gig nonetheless, and I was a huge fan of Soul Coughing. When I next saw Mike Doty, I was walking down 6th Street in Austin, Texas, about a month ago for the South by Southwest conference, and having spoken with Meg Smith from the Berkman Center, who said, you know, when you're down there, see if you can't find, like, a really good, really smart, digitally, you know, with it musician that can come up and speak for this interview session. I literally had that on my mind as I walked past Mike Doty on 6th Street. I said, hey, you're Mike Doty. Said, yeah. And so we started talking briefly as we walked down the street. And so we're really, you know, a month later, a few phone calls later, we've got Mike Doty here to speak with us. So as I mentioned, Mike was with a band called Soul Coughing. And it started in
92.
And went up through 2000. He's maintained a pretty active solo career since then. Most recently signed to Dave Matthews' label.
ATO,
ATO, great. And now you've got a new album coming up.
Yeah, it's called Haughty Melodic.
Okay, when's that coming out?
May 3rd.
Okay, great. So we're going to talk a lot about kind of the creative process, as Charlie mentioned, how Mike uses the creative process, how that's changed over the years, specifically with regards to technology and some of the legal issues surrounding that. And then towards the end, we're starting a little bit late, but towards the end, we're going to open it up for a few questions. So if people have any questions for Mike or for anything, then we'll feel free to ask them then. So let's just get started, Mike, with, you know, when did you... Well, here comes a mic for you there. Let's get that started first. And we've got to give Mike some props for being able to play guitar at...
Yeah, really.
At 9:30
sort
in the morning.
On rock and roll hour.
And not only that, but he was teaching himself a Depeche Mode song in the background there at like 8:30 this morning. So that's...
Seriously.
We've got a troubadour here. So when did you write your first song?
I guess I started trying to rip off chord progressions from other songs when I was like 15 years old. And I figured out that there were basically like a few of them in the repertoire. There was...
Three chords.
Yeah. Well, and more than that, there's probably like five of them. There was like this... Velvet Underground's Sister Ray, which is... You know. Working Sally inside. Which is also, among a million other things, Jonathan Richman, Harvard alums. Roadrunner, Roadrunner. Going 1,000 miles an hour. This is like the most pedantic example is Louie Louie, which is... which is also Wild Thing. And
he's good loving too, isn't he?
Yeah. And ba ba da da bamba. You know, so there, yeah, so basically I figured out that, you know, I didn't have any theory, I didn't take lessons. I sort of figured out these very rudimentary versions of songs. And figured out that I could write anything I wanted to, just learning these sort of little building blocks of riffs.
Once you cracked a fairly basic code, it opened up a whole lot of things to you.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So what were you listening to at the time when you started, when you were 15 and kind of trying to pull chords from...
Run DMC, The Rolling Stones, okay. The Replacements, Velvet Underground... just like sort of standard rock stuff and some of the hip-hop stuff that was going on.
And as you've continued to write songs, I mean, how many songs roughly would you say that you've probably written?
Oh, God, I mean, in terms of like registered published songs, 100, yeah. But I mean, in terms of songs, I don't know.
And as you've continued to write over the years, you've continued to listen to music and pull ideas and stuff. What are some of your more recent influences?
Well, I'm a song guy. The perfect scenario for me is iTunes, because I just have like a pop song that I really like. At the moment, there's that Amaury song, One Thing, which is just blows my mind. The new Kelly Clarkson song, I'm Sorry, it's just an amazing piece of writing. Yeah, oh, just an amazing piece of writing. Melody writing, I should say, lyrically, it's, you know, whatever. But
what chords does that use? Have you figured that one out yet?
Yeah, it's... Da-da-da, da-da-da-da,
da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
You know, and actually, I can't really sing the tune, so I'm trying to figure out a way to rip off the chords. So it's this thing that really gives it away, so I'm trying to, like, just do...
Well, when we first started talking about doing this event, we started saying, well, let's think about, like, some songs that you've written recently, and have you tried to trace the influence... kind of lineage of that song, and I think he's come up with one, which I think is pretty interesting.
When I sit down to write songs, a lot of times I look at what I'm listening to and think, how can I adapt this? And I was listening to a song by an 80s metal band called Iron Maiden called Number of the Beast, and it goes like this. I lived alone, my mind was blank, I needed time to blah, 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 blah. And so I simplified it a little bit and sort of changed the structure of the chords, not the actual chords, but just like the tonic on the chord, and turned it into a song. It's actually my new single with that Cuban... Wait. That Cuban girl brought me low. She had that skin so fine, her red lips rose like now. So it's from I lived alone to that Cuban girl. Just enough to, like, get past the lawyers, really. But I mean, choices made for aesthetic purposes, not for legal purposes.
Was there a moment that you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
There was. I had this moment I was playing. I lived alone. My mind was blank. And I suddenly realized, oh, when the saints go marching in... So
it wasn't Eddie from Iron Maiden that wrote that. It goes way back.
I mean, melodies.
Now, in that reaction, I think, is pretty typical among a lot of artists in terms of, you know, you're borrowing from your past, and you can't help but soak up, you know, what you're listening to and to somehow kind of translate that through your filter. Mm-hmm. That, a lot of ways, is the role of an artist is to kind of present a vision that brings in their surroundings, just as all of us kind of live in these lives. In today's age, when you start to realize, shit, that's an Iron Maiden song. Mm-hmm. Is there ever enter into the equation like, oh gosh, we are going to have to use the lawyers? Do I have to change this to avoid, like, attracting legal attention?
There have been occasions when I've done that, when I've just demoed something and you know, I sort of give it to my manager and he goes, dude, that's a Tom Petty song. Like, you got to change that. Yeah. Generally, if you can get it past my manager. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. In the case of the Tom Petty song, I didn't even know I was ripping it off. It was just, I mean, it's perfect examples. I'm just sort of picking something out of the ooze. And as it turns out, it's been written a million times by a million other copyright holders.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think the Rolling Stones had an example of that in, like, the late 90s when they had their first single off of one of their other albums.
And it was...
rip off of Katie Lang.
Exactly.
And they had to give her credit.
They actually paid Katie Lang. It was apparently an intentional ripoff. Okay. There's another example of a George Harrison song called My Sweet Lord, which was... it was like a Sherelle song or something. And that, George Harrison swore, was unintentional. Hmm. And everyone was like, oh, yeah, it's unintentional, right? But I believe him. Like, I absolutely believe him.
He was in the Beatles. We can give him, like, a bit of... Now, your solo work is more of kind of the singer-songwriter thing, whereas with your first band or first maiden band?
Yeah, first signed
major
band,
label band, Soul Coughing, relied on a lot of sampling, relied on a lot of like triggered samples and kind of bringing a lot of different sonic elements into the song. Was there, back then in like 92 and stuff, were there the kind of clearance issues that you had to concern yourself with?
Well, we recorded, we were very involved with samples. We're sort of well known for using samples of Raymond Scott, who was the composer for the cartoon music using the Warner Brothers cartoons, the Bugs Bunny cartoons. So we turned in an album to Warner Brothers. It was just laden with samples, TV themes, recordings, you know, bits of our own music. And we were told...
What year was this?
93.
Okay.
This was right in the wake of the Bismarcky case. Bismarcky sampled a Gilbert O'Sullivan song, and it was before the labels got hip to sampling, really. So all of a sudden, the lawyers came after Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers was just shocked. They had no idea that their artists were doing this. So it was a nightmare, and they put on this boilerplate thing in the contracts that said, any sample you use, absolutely every single sample you use, you have to declare to us. And our lawyer said, that's not what that means.
Take notes on that, dude.
What that means is anything that they can bust you for, you have to tell them about. And so, oh, great. We heard a story about another band on Warner Brothers who read the clause and just sort of, oh, okay. And it listed literally every single sample they used. There were like snare drum hits and just these little bits, these tiny little things that they used that no one would have caught. And when looking at them on a big piece of paper, it ended up being like a $1.2 million worth of clearances. So they got dropped. They never put out an album. I should say there are things on our first album that we didn't declare that blow my mind that people haven't caught us for. And on the other hand, we had a sample of Stubby K, the old Broadway singer, singing something from the original soundtrack of Guys and Dolls. The estate of Stubby K contacted us before we put the record out.
They're everywhere. The estate of Stubby K.
Well, we had sent it out to publishing people and sort of looking for soundtrack placements and stuff like that. And apparently somebody heard it that knew somebody that knew somebody, and they got us before the record even came out. Hmm.
Did that hold up the process? Or did...
No.
No, okay. No. Now, when that started happening with you in 93 and whatnot, if I recall correctly, and we have a much more versed historian of hip-hop coming up later in Wayne, which is a very interesting interlude, there was a lot of sampling happening. I mean, that was kind of, you know, a lot of what was driving hip-hop culture in the early 90s with the De La Soul, with Bismarcky, with Paul's Boutique from the Beastie Boys in 89, I believe, was just all samples.
It was really like the exciting thing was combining different genres. You know, it was really exciting to find some unmined area of music. You know, in recent years... you know, Nas had that song that quoted Beethoven's For Elise. I don't think there's a copyright problem with that, which was awesome for Nas. Really the first use of a classical sample. Jay-Z has that song, Hard Knock Life, that samples Annie, which, you know, nobody had really gone to Broadway before. So, yeah, I mean, there was like a real sort of point of pride thing to like getting a sample or a genre that hadn't been used before.
But it seems as though the use of sampling, the kind of the collage of sampling that had been starting to really kind of develop in the late 80s, early mid 90s, before the legal kind of constructs were placed on it, you don't really see that much. You cited a couple examples, but it seems like we were talking about how some of today's hip-hop producers have totally changed.
It's interesting that the biggest producers are the Neptunes, Timbaland, Manny Fresh, who does all the Cash Money music. These are all guys that compose music that sounds like samples. The Neptunes just have this incredible knack at coming up with these 2 or 4 bar bits that they can put things in, take things out. You know, they're just a few elements, and really the art of the music is combining and recombining the different little elements. Timbaland, another producer, uses samples, but he filters them in such a way, you know, accents certain frequencies, takes out certain frequencies, that there's no way you could be able to tell really where it comes
from. They'll pass the sample sniffer test so that they won't be able to be recognized.
Yeah.
What effect do you think that is a result of the incredible cost, the $1.2 million worth of clearance that that bands would have to have if they wanted to continue doing those kind of sound collages?
Well, I think the artists and the managers wanted the money. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make a difference to the labels. The labels get their cut. The artist pays for all this stuff. It comes out of the record budget. Mm-hmm. So I think the artists looked at it and were like, well, you know, I'd rather have that $5,000 or that 10% of my publishing or whatever it was.
So that's interesting that because of the legal constructs put up on sampling and the fact that it was coming out of the artist's pocket, the artists changed the way they were creating music to avoid those kind of fees and whatnot that the legal system was putting into. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned earlier that the iTunes is kind of a perfect situation for you.
Sure.
In terms of when you're creating to be able to, what's that song? What's it? Just 99 cents,
yeah.
Bang, you've got
yeah.
it. Of course, iTunes hasn't been around for more than, I think, 2 years now,
uh-huh.
2.5 years now. And Soul Coughing stuff and your first solo stuff started showing up on Napster in like the late 90s.
That's right.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what you did?
I have a really interesting story about Napster, which was I recorded an acoustic album in the middle of the 90s when I was still in Soul Coughing, and it really was kind of the musical foundation of what I'm doing now. And it was rejected by Warner Brothers. I put it on a shelf. I figured, you know, you win some, you lose some. A few years later, I go out on the road doing an acoustic tour, and people in the front row are lip-syncing these songs. They're requesting this. I remember I played at Princeton, and there was like a beam in the hall, and someone had printed out a song title from that album and had pasted it to the beam so I would see it when I was on stage and maybe play it. And what happened was the record got out on Napster. And I had this album that was in the culture that I hadn't put out.
And you were paying money for.
Well, I mean, I ended up printing up a bunch of them and selling them on the road. I was kind of pissed off. The mixes that got out on Napster, some of them I didn't like so much. It was, you could speculate. Maybe the producer was like bitter about Warner Brothers rejecting this thing, or there's all kinds of theories about how they got out there.
Mm-hmm. But you, as a result of it being out of Napster, didn't you decide to just go ahead and release it immediately?
Oh, yeah,
to get
big
it out
time.
There?
You know, the thing about the file sharing age is it's a great time to be me. It's a great time to be an artist who has an audience, who has a career, who got started in the early 90s when major labels still signed bands that could only sell under 100,000 records. They'd rent you a van, pay for you to be on the road. So I got all that capital to really build a touring career. And having an album out like that is just going to sort of fuel my shows, fuel all these sort of, formerly ancillary parts of my career.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I worry about is the new artist, particularly in an age where music is made on laptops. There's a piece of software called AutoTune. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it does exactly what it says. You can sound horrible, and you go dip, 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 and you're in tune. And this is the career of Jennifer Lopez, essentially.
Isn't that, and Ashley Simpson, I think, endorses that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. All the Hillary Duff and Ryan Cooper, all these guys, it's all about autotune. Autotune is going to get so good in the next 5 years that you will not even have to sing as well as Jennifer Lopez does to create a song. So these artists are not going to be able to go out on the road and make a living touring. I think for the most part, if you make music on a laptop, what are you going to do for a show? You're going to put the laptop on stage and hit the space bar and just stand there going, all right, you pay $12 to get in, yeah, woo. So I really, file sharing's not going away.
Right.
It's not going away. It's permanent. And it's really going to affect the ability of younger, newer artists to make a living as a professional musician.
Mm-hmm. It seems as though you've made peace with the file sharing community.
Yeah.
I noticed that you have a link on your website.
Yeah, I have a link on my site, on my blog, that says Amnesty for File Sharers and Downloaders. And there's a link to the Musicians Assistance Program. You can donate $5 or $10. It started out as a joke I did before Christmas. I set up an Amazon wish list, and I just found the most ludicrous things you could buy on Amazon. A spatula, a ball peen hammer, a bar of soap, thing of toothpaste, and it said, listen, if you downloaded something, you could buy me one of these, and people bought them all, so I changed it to a It's like a charity thing.
You got to upgrade that Amazon list. You
yeah, really.
The DVD, the flat screen TV.
Yeah, if they sell a Volkswagen, I'll put that on there.
So to your point about file sharing and younger bands today, you're saying that because people can get the albums for free, can get music for free, that if they don't have the talent, if they use all these new technological tools to build their records, they won't necessarily be a touring act, which is where you're seeing most of the income coming in for artists these days.
I mean, maybe it'll have an effect that, you know, if you want to be a musician, unlike today, you really will have to be able to play live.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I can only see that as a positive thing.
How have these tools that you're talking about shaped your songwriting? I mean, do you still develop a song as a kernel of an idea? To what effect do they influence your actual songwriting, or are they more dressing?
I sort of use autotune and things like that more as in production, which mm-hmm. is after the songwriting has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you hit a bad note here or there. I mean, on the other hand, making music on computers and the overwhelming amounts of possibility, it's like the dark arts, man. You can just go in and be in there forever and perfect everything. You know, like when I made this record, we would record the vocal. Everything would be done except the vocal. We'd do the vocal. And I'd do like 20 passes, 25 passes at the vocal. And then the freedom of doing it on Pro Tools is you can literally go through and find a word in every take that is exactly in tune, that is the most expressive, whatever it is. So I would be sitting there, and the producer would be sitting there with the mouse, and just listening all day to, and, and. You're like, I think take 8 is the right one. You know, we got a whole verse from take 7. Can you believe it?
Well, that's great. You had said earlier this morning that in thinking more about inspiration and where you borrowed stuff, that you realized that you had uncovered another song that you had pulled from.
Yeah,
go into that.
There was a song on my new album called White Lexus, and
put that on your wish list.
Yeah, really. Oh boy. But there was a little bit from Depeche Mode's Blasphemous Rumors that I took, just a little tiny bit, and I built the song around it. And I just figured out the Depeche Mode song, so forgive me if I'm stumbling. I'm just going to la-la-la it. La 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 la. Dum, 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 dum. And the thing that I really liked was dum, 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 dum. Dum, 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 dum. Dum, 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 dum. Just something about those notes. So I ripped it off, essentially. And I'll play the actual song.
Yeah,
I'll play the whole song.
And then we'll take some questions after that.
Can you hear everything all right? Please show me how to live. Please show me how to have a day. I don't want to wake up now. Why do I have to wake up anyway? Like a soap star in anguish, real but bland. Here it comes. When your white Lexus comes around the way, idling in a long driveway, try to feel nothing on command. When your white Lexus comes through, be damned up. I'll forgive the world right now. Still I play the trump's role every time. My world's the surface of the moon. My heart's down in a diamond mine. Like the soul stars of Memphis moaning on. When your white Lexus comes to drive me out, drive me to the edge of town. Try to feel nothing on command. When your
your white Lexus comes to thrill me down, damn it's the last damn man. When your white Lexus comes, when your white Lexus comes. That's it.
All right. What was the snippet there that was from the white? I couldn't discern.
It was
what part of the song was the?
Okay. Which was
when your white Lexus comes.
Excellent.
Everyone got.
Oh, that's three notes. I don't know. That might be trouble. When does the new album come out?
May 3rd. The album drops.
Album drops.
As the rappers say, on May 3rd.
And he's actually playing the Middle East up the street on, I think, May 7th, around that time?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, great. Let's look to see if anybody has any questions for Mike about the inspiration process or effective legal issues on the... yes, right here.
There's virtually no fair use. No use is fair, or there. I don't understand the legal.
You were talking about sampling, mm-hmm. and the group that even if they used a little bit of a snare drum, that would not be considered fair use in the copyright sense, that it could be used with just asking for permission and not having to pay for it.
I mean, I don't think there's really any real fair use anywhere, right? I mean, from a strict legal, right?
Well, again, the thing is, if you can get busted for it, it's against the law. I mean, my lawyer once told me that a record deal should say, if you sell a lot of records, we'll give you a lot of money. And that's it. It should be written on a cocktail napkin. Because everything else is completely up for grabs. So, you know, if you go to the guy that did the snare hit originally, you'll have to give the dough. But otherwise, nobody's going to get it, you know?
Got a question over there?
Yes. So I guess to follow up on that question, is it... Oh, sure. Wendy Seltzer, a fellow with the Berkman Center and an attorney at EFF. I was here at the first Signal or Noise 5 years ago as well. And this is already starting to be a great follow-up. The question about fair use is one that, of course, troubles me a lot. And so is it if you can get busted for it, is that if somebody's going to come after you and sue you?
Yes. I mean, it's a yes, absolutely. Yeah.
more than if at the end of the day you'll win that lawsuit or lose it.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to, and the guy who recognizes it goes, oh, that's cool. They took my thing.
Chilling effects.
In the back.
Hi, thanks for your comments about the early soul coughing days. I was a big fan, and I you're right when you say that you were like one of the seminal sort of sample-based pop groups. And I've kind of wondered about, I'm Pacey Foster from Boston College. And I've wondered about folks in your position. I don't want to out any of your samples, which have been the object of much of my study over the years. And, you know, you talk about finding a code in songs when you were writing songs, and there's something about that when you love a band and they're a sample-based band, you're kind of trying to decode their, their research. So that those albums represented research, and so I just wanted to make that point. But also, I wanted to ask you, because I've never had a chance to ask someone like you about the legal issue now that you've released these albums. Apparently, you haven't gone back and cleared everything. So where does that stand? I mean, how do you handle that issue?
Like, well, there's a lot on those albums that was cleared. The Randy Scott sample, there was a Toots and the Maytals sample, a Roaches sample. There was actually the Roaches, we cleared the sample through them, and they didn't want money. They actually wanted us to never say that we had sampled them. They thought we were like a gangster rap. Wow. Seriously.
But so like Paul's Boutique, all these records that were sample pastiches and collages, are they still, I mean, is there a point at which it's, you know, over and you can't be sued for that stuff? Is that stuff just out there as legal liability, or where does that stand?
You know, I just sort of know this stuff in the space of time between you finish the album and the album comes out. I don't know what happens if 7 years later somebody hears it and goes, that's my damn song, you know? No idea.
Speaking about decoding an album, I don't know if anyone in here has ever seen, there's a website called the Annotated Paul's Boutique. You can probably do a Google search on it now where somebody has gone back and tried to uncover as many of the thousands and thousands of samples that were the basis of the Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique. Any other questions before we turn over the next session? Yep, up here in front.
Hi, I'm Jake Shapiro, also a Berkman Fellow. So do you think it's a good thing that the fact of the fear over costs of sampling or clearing all those samples and the trend that's forced people away from doing that has made it so that the producers of those things are actually forced to be more creative about, like as you said, with Neptune sort of creating their own original works that sound like samples? Would you rather have heard it if sampling had become cheap and easy and free, that more artists and more producers would be using almost exclusively samples for everything that they do?
Well, a bunch of answers to that. I always find it really interesting and energizing how technology affects music, you know, down to the fact that, in the early 50s, a song had to be 3 minutes long to fit on a 45, and then with the LP, you know, things like that. So yeah, the legal issue dictated the rise of the Neptunes, who were just brilliant, right, brilliant producers. In terms of, if sampling became free and easy in the 90s, I think eventually people would sort of abandon that. It would become old hat, and people sort of eventually be driven to making their own loops. And you know, in terms of how I feel about it as a songwriter, if I hear something and I can recognize that I'm on there, I do want to get paid for it. You know, I'm not into like, cool, it's anarchy out there. I got to pay my rent, you know. If somebody uses something and it's buried or it's altered in a really clever, interesting way, I have no problem with it. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thanks. Yeah. Have you found stuff that people have buried of yours out there?
Yeah, like rhythms and things like that, very sort of basic.
And you're pretty forgiving in terms of students wanting to use your songs in films.
Yeah, I get an email almost every other day from a student filmmaker that wants to use a song, and I'm like, look, as long as you're not making money off it, and if you do start making money off it, I'm not the guy to talk to. You got to talk to somebody at Warner Chappell Publishing Company.
I think just to kind of a final note, we were talking about technology shaping music from the 45 songs had to be a certain length. It's interesting. It seems as though legal issues have started shaping music to some extent as well, with specifically the sample issue and whatnot. So that will probably be fodder for future discussion today. I'd like to thank Mike Doty for coming up here and entertaining us.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.